Did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? And they found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to create gummies, baked goods, and flower for whatever type of buzz you'd want. I'm talking about Mood.com. They have an incredible line of cannabis gummies, and you get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. This isn't some rinky-dink discount of 5 or 10%. This is 20% off your first order. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. My favorite are the Sleepy Time Advanced gummies. That's right, those are for sleepy time. You know when you just can't fall asleep? Take these and they'll put you right in the mood. Beyond gummies, Mood also has a selection of flower, pre-rolls, bakery treats, and beverages. Listen, you can find gummies to just get you high pretty much everywhere these days. But Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get into the perfect mood, usually in as little as 15 minutes. And everything ships discreetly right to your door. No dispensary lines, no awkward conversations, just better days and nights delivered to your doorstep. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. So head to Mood.com, find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code SPECIALISTS when you check out to save 20% on your first order. Try it today at mood.com.
IPVanish protects every device you own, your phone, your laptop, your smart TV. If it connects to the internet, it should be protected. IPVanish encrypts your connection and masks your IP address, helping keep your browsing private at home and on public Wi-Fi. And with no device limits, one account covers everything. Stream with added privacy. Browse securely. Connect with confidence. Right now, save 83% off the 2-year plan. Get started today at ipvanish.com/audio and take control of your privacy with IPVanish.
Movie buff specialist Phil and John are back as we continue counting down our top 100 movies of all time. And today we are on to number 49. That's right, we are into the 40s. We are talking about Double Indemnity and You Only Live Twice, the James Bond movie, the Billy Wilder movie, film noir, all that fun stuff. Want to throw this in at the very beginning, though. Oscar nominations were announced yesterday, and John and I are going to be doing a retrospective, or whatever you want to call it, a review, I guess is the better word for this. A review of all 10 of the Best Picture nominees over on the Patreon channel for Survivor Specialists. So if you become a $5 patron, you'll get that. If you're interested in what we're going to say, it'd be a deeper dive, about a half hour on each movie. So that's three. What is that? There's 10. That's 5 hours of extra content that you could get, $5 for the month. And this is all going to be done this month. So if you're looking to just give $5 to hear two people talk about movies, you can pretty much bail after May or after February, which hopefully we can come up with other content for March. But although I guess the Oscars are very late in March this year, so I guess we could get a little bit of this bleeding into March. Plus, I'm going to have to find a way to watch Drive My Car because it's playing pretty much nowhere within the vicinity of where I live. So we'll figure that one out. But very excited that the Oscar nominations were announced, even if I've only seen 4 of the 10 Best Picture nominees. But patreon.com/Survivor Specialist, it's down there in the chat. And if you're tuning in today thinking that you're going to be getting a Survivor cast announcement, sorry, that's going to be tomorrow night at 6 p.m. because I know it was announced today, but this is not what's going to be happening tonight. And tonight we're just going to be focusing on movies. That's a little housekeeping. John, we're on number 49. You Only Live Twice, Double Indemnity. Pretty fun evening, I think, planned ahead here, considering the subject matter of these two movies. Obviously, Double Indemnity, a little bit darker of a movie, but it's still got that Billy Wilder fun to it, and it's a film noir, and film noirs always find a way to be fun, even when they're super negative. And You Only Live Twice is James Bond at almost his absolute finest, in my opinion. I know he's at his absolute finest in yours. Why do you have You Only Live Twice up here? And we'll talk about that one in a second, but I just want to hear why you have it here.
I think this is the, like, when you think James Bond, almost everything you think James Bond is because of You Only Live Twice. Mm-hmm. I just think it's like this prototypical James Bond movie. And when we do discuss it later, I'll get into a lot of these just like spy tropes that are essentially exist because of this movie.
Yeah, I totally agree. I do think that this, like, Goldfinger's the quintessential Bond, but this is the one that gets a little bit more over the top as Bond. Yeah. It was also might make sense that this is Sean Connery's last one before he makes the comeback, obviously. But this is his last one, and maybe it was when they were just starting to kind of feel it a little bit more, not trying to be as serious. Yeah, this does kind of have that feel with the volcano lair and all of that stuff. But we're going to start off tonight with Double Indemnity, a movie that John had never seen, of course, because John has never seen any of my movies as we go through them. But I really think that this might be the quintessential film noir. If we're talking about You Only Live Twice as the quintessential Bond movie, or as, you know, what kind of invented this genre or further this genre into what we recognize it as today, Double Indemnity is the ultimate film noir. It is just pure perfection. Fred McMurray, Barbara Stanwyck, Edward G. Robinson, the three performances are absolutely fantastic. McMurray's character of Walter Neff is so much fun to watch. Phyllis Dietrichson is one of the biggest villains in film history. I don't care what anybody says. I love the style of this movie. I love the dialogue. It really helps that Raymond Carver helped write this script, because Raymond Carver, one of the great mystery writers of all time. This movie just flies by. It clicks along. And for a film noir, it's so hard to be original in any way. This movie feels so original. It feels so well thought out with this whole double indemnity clause and the injury and getting pushed off the train. There's so many layers to this movie that we don't necessarily see in every film noir. And that's why I think from the era of film noir, you know, talking about the 40s, late, you know, call it the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, this is the best one in my estimation, and the one that should be kind of looked at as the defining feature of film noir in the in Hollywood.
Yeah, and I think what Double Indemnity does really well is it expands the film noir past, like, the gumshoe era that it was in prior to this, where we're getting a different look at the film noir genre from a different different viewpoint than we have previously. Because normally, with the noirs that are coming up before this, we have that the PI and the suave PI who's kind of like the bad boy, you know, the Humphrey Bogarts and of the world and everything like that. But what Double Indemnity really gives us is, here's a man who has, like, this everyday job that's super boring, but we get to frame it in this really exciting way. And it just goes to show what Billy Wilder did for Hollywood. I'm just, while watching this film, you just have all of these ideas of what wouldn't exist today if this movie was never made.
Yeah, exactly. And I think this whole idea, you know, we see it a lot with Shane Black, with Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Mm-hmm. We see it with a lot of movies that Brick, you know, movies that try to be neo-noir now. They're always going now for, it's not a private eye. It's just a random person who gets sucked into this underbelly of whatever society they're in. This is really, and I'm sure I'm off on this because I don't really know the timing of all the film noirs, but this is one of the first film noirs that doesn't follow around a PI in any way, shape, or form. There's no cop in this movie. Yep. Like, I don't think there's a single police officer in this entire movie. And if there is, it's very, very brief. But it is just about that regular, everyday guy who has a job, is just lonely, meets the femme fatale, and everything just starts to fall apart for him. And we see that a lot in, like, what happens in the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, and all that, where it's moving away from, you know, the Maltese Falcon, the whole Sam Spade type thing. And it's starting to get more into, you know, just anybody else. Sunset Boulevard, a movie we talked about a couple weeks ago. That is a film noir. And that is about a writer who just gets mixed up in this world with a femme fatale unlike any other. So I think that this was really a turning point for this genre, because at this point, the genre had already started to feel stale here in the early 1940s. We obviously had a lot of really good ones come out later, like Out of the Past and things along those lines. But the genre had started to kind of, it's starting to mope along, and people are starting to get tired of this whole, like, brooding thing. They wanted these bigger pictures, which is why you start to see the musicals start to come in the 1950s, the color and all that. But this was, I think, like, a turning point. And I also think it's probably one of the more underseen of the classic film noirs in terms of the Maltese Falcon. And I just keep going back to the Maltese Falcon, but, like, the because it doesn't have Humphrey Bogart, I think that does actually hurt it a little bit in terms of people being going and seeing it and visiting it and all that. Yeah. But I think the fact that it is Fred McMurray is also what kind of sets this one apart, because you can't really compare it to all of the others at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so different than anything else that was coming out at the time. And it's just the way it's framed. We get that classic noir narrative there, where we start with, the voiceover, the recap voiceover. We had it again. Mm-hmm. Wilder does it again in Sunset Boulevard afterwards. But it feels so cozy to have this voiceover just recanting everything that's happening, as then we see it play out afterwards, after we're kind of introduced to the situation.
Yeah, and something I loved about this, so when I was watching this, it had the intro by Robert Osborne from TCM, because I rented the DVD from the library. And so it had the intro from Robert Osborne, and he was talking about how they got Edward G. Robinson to be in this movie, and how Edward G. Robinson didn't want to take the role originally because he had been a leading man the whole time. Mm-hmm. And now this means he's going to have to take a side role, and that's going to mean, well, my career is coming to an end. He'd been around since the early 30s. That's not what he wanted to do, but he just couldn't help but do this movie. And I think what's so fascinating about it is you get such a buildup of what this guy is like from Fred McMurray's voiceover at the beginning of this, that by the time he walks on screen, you're like, it's this little guy chomping on his cigar. Like you get almost an imposing figure from the description from this voiceover. And I always love it. It always became the new school style of voiceovers, lazy writing, and all that. And adaptation did that to film, because Robert McKee was in that movie playing Robert McKee. Yep. And so, you know, all of that comes from that. But in reality, when you use voiceover like this, it doesn't matter. And it's helping to build the characters. It's helping to move forward the story. And it's helping to create the setting of what this world is. How did this guy get to this point where he's been shot clearly, and he's hurting in this office, and he's talking to this, and he's talking to somebody who seems like a friend, but you already know right away it was a massive betrayal, and the guy who's sitting there got nothing from it. So how is this going to play out? And I think, obviously Edward G. Robinson's character when he comes in is so great, but I love that it keeps going back and forth between the voiceover, and it gives purpose to why the voiceover is actually happening in this movie.
Yeah, it's important that, unlike Sunset Boulevard, where the voiceover is happening literally at the last moments of that film, that this is happening with that little bit of segment afterwards of like, okay, how do we deal with this still?
Yeah. And what's nice about that, a lot of times voiceover will come in and then it'll just be gone. This movie really uses it throughout the entire time. I was thinking about in Seven, how there's no voiceover. And at the very end of the movie, Morgan Freeman has that voiceover line. And like, it just feels so out of nowhere. Like, they didn't know what the punchline of the movie was going to be. Who is he talking to? He hasn't talked to us the entire movie. And in this movie, though, it's like, okay, we know that a story is being told. This isn't them telling us a story. He is telling his what is Edward G. Robinson's name in this movie? I can't even remember. But he is telling him the story of it.
Keys.
Barton Keys or something like that. Yeah. With the little man in his stomach, and he's chomping on his cigar, and he's never been wrong. But I also, what I think is brilliant about this movie is, you know, he gets caught. And while he's going through everything, you see how well thought out everything is. And in the back of your mind the whole time, you're like, but he's been talking up this Keys guy a lot. This Keys guy always has the answer. He always has the answer. And you're just waiting for the other shoe to drop the entire movie.
Yeah, and I think what's really interesting about the way it's framed, too, you're rooting for Barton Keys to get him, too. The entire time, you're just like, I know he's going to, but I want to see it. That's what I'm waiting for. It's not a feeling of dread for the protagonist of this film to be caught. It's a feeling of anticipation, just waiting for it, because you know it's going to be so exciting. And I think Barton Keys is one of the greatest heroes that we've ever seen in a movie who is not the focus of a movie.
Yeah. And I think that goes to how great of an anti-hero Walter Neff is.
Absolutely.
And I know you had asked me, like, is Walter Neff the first anti-hero in film? I don't think so, because I think Sam Spade would fit into that role. And I don't know, there's probably somebody else. I mean, Scarlett O'Hara was in the 30s, but
yeah, of course.
But it is interesting to see how much of a hero Keys is in this movie, and how kind of despicable they keep Neff the entire time. I like that Neff has no family. Neff isn't cheating on anybody. Neff isn't screwing anybody over except himself and this miserable family anyway. The only one he's really hurting is Lola, because Lola is innocent in the entire matter. The both Dietrichsons, they suck. Yep. Both of them are terrible. And so Neff is really going in and trying to thwart this already bad family. But you also get the backstory of, oh, yeah, it's the nurse from when his wife died and all of these little things that it's just like it just keeps building on itself to create that sense of dread of like, how does this guy not see it coming? What is he thinking as he's getting into this? But that's the beauty of film noir. It's always these fast talking, PIs or whatever role they're mm-hmm. in. And they always get suckered in by the femme fatale. It doesn't matter who or what that femme fatale is doing.
Yeah, and when we're looking at Barbara Stanwyck's performance as Phyllis in this movie, you immediately see her and you know, oh, this is a femme fatale. But she still kind of has this like innocence to her throughout. It's a phenomenal performance that makes it so that you as an audience member just aren't quite sure how this is going to turn out in the end.
Yeah, part of you keeps thinking, okay, like, is she going to kill him? Is she the one who shoots him? Is he going to kill her? Like, what is her? Is she just going to run away? I love the Nino Sacchetti stuff, how they keep that mm-hmm. involved throughout the entire movie. Like, and that's the best part. When I was in a screenwriting class in college, the best advice a professor ever gave me is don't just keep introducing new characters. Work with what you have. Because a lot of, like, writers in general, this isn't just, you know, early screenwriters. This is anybody. They try to introduce a new character for every kind of plot point. But if it's not Nino Sacchetti, we don't care. So use what you have. Use Nino Sacchetti as Lola's weird boyfriend who nobody likes, that the father can't stand, who's also now doing something with Barbara Stanwyck to move himself up and potentially put that as the thought of, could this be the killer with her, so that it leaves Walter Neff out of it. And that's how he's going to end up getting away. And how is he going to blow this for himself? There's really not that many characters in this movie. Jackson from Medford, great side character. Like all of these little characters that just pop up throughout and are used in numerous ways. They don't just come and then disappear. They come and they stay and they linger. And it creates this claustrophobia of what does Key say? You know, a murder, eventually in a murder, everybody always gets caught. But when there's two people who commit a murder, it increases by 100 times or whatever it is. Like you're always going to get caught because there's two people now involved. And in this world where everybody is screwing everybody and you think, well, Phyllis Dietrichson is not going to screw over Walter Neff. Yes, she is. That's what she's actually in the process of doing pretty much the entire movie.
Yeah. And that's this ending of this film is really, it's one of the great twist endings where it just comes out and it's like, because it doesn't seem like Phyllis has the killer instinct, which we should have known because she literally trying to kill her husband. But it doesn't seem like she has the foresight to get to this point. The fact that she just waited until the perfect time to kill her husband based on the opportunity that was presented.
Yeah. And it's all selfish the entire time. And I love her part of like, we're not what we used to be. We're none of this. There was never anything. You just wanted to get rid of this guy. That's all you wanted to do. You just wanted to get rid of this guy so that you could have your freedom and do what you wanted to do and get the money and get the hell out of there. She's one of the best femme fatales ever. I think the only one who really comes close is probably, well, there's a couple who come close, but I really like Kim Basinger in the LA Confidential, which we get to in a couple weeks when I have that one. But I really like Kim Basinger's character in that movie because I think it's a different style of femme fatale. And Phyllis Dietrichson, like really, Phyllis Dietrichson is in control this entire movie. If you think about like a movie like Chinatown, Faye Dunaway plays a great, great, great femme fatale. But her character is not really in control. J.J. Gitz is definitely still in control. And I call him Gitz, not Giddies, because, you know. But he's still in control during that movie. She's not. It's the other people and him who are kind of like battling for it. But in this movie, it's very much Phyllis Dietrichson who has all of the motive, who knows everything. It's not that just that she's going to reveal a secret kind of like at the end of Chinatown. She has literally plotted everything out better than this person who just had a really good job of plotting everything out could do. She just ran circles around him and he was running circles around everybody. Like he was doing such a good job that even Keyes couldn't see it right away. And you know, the scene of her coming in and that intensity that there is when she comes into the office and she just acts like, I don't even know what you're talking about. And, oh yeah, we've met, but that's it. It's just so cool. It's so calm. The character just is what she is the entire time. And I think when you have a great film noir, it has to be clicking on all levels. It has to have the dialogue. Mm-hmm. It has to have the story. It has to have a great protagonist. It has to have a really, really solid cast of side characters. And it has to have a great femme fatale. And Double Indemnity has literally every single point of those that you could possibly need. And it excels at having all of that. It's just, it's unbelievable.
Well, I think that's what really makes this, puts this movie above a lot of others from ever. And why it is widely considered one of the greatest movies ever made, it comes down to the fact that our three main characters in Neff, Phyllis Dietrichson, and Keyes are also equally strong characters, mm-hmm. that none of them are ever vying with each other for screen time. They're all playing off each other on the scenes when they do share a screen together. And when they don't share a screen together, it's not like they're towering over anyone with their presence. It's a respectful presence. And that is, pardon, that has to do with the fact that the characters do just respect each other the entire movie.
Well, and that's what I was going to say. I think what really helps this movie is how smart every character is. A lot of movies make the mistake of not having these characters, not having all of their characters be equally mentally equal to each other. Mm-hmm. This movie, you have people who are learning from the best of the best, who have connived their way through their lives to get to where they are. Insurance salesmen, whatever it is, like they have worked their way up through all of this. And now we're getting to see them, you know, put it all together to try to screw each other over. It's fascinating because a lot of times in movies, you'll have like at least one character who's just willing to be walked all over. You know, in Sunset Boulevard, what's his name? Norma Desmond's butler guy. He's just willing to be walked all over. Norma Desmond is completely out of her mind. But in this movie, they're not just side characters with their own motives. All of their motives are actually playing off of the other person's motive. It's not just, oh, we all want to get the Maltese Falcon. No, it's she wants to get her husband out of the way. He wants the money and the girl. And Edward G. Robinson wants to catch whoever this is because he's really good at his job and he just can't, you know, ever accept being wrong. And we have all three of them doing everything they can to succeed at what they're succeeding at. Now we get definitely more in the minds of Walter Neff and Keyes because Keyes will blatantly have conversations with Neff because he doesn't think Neff is the killer. Neff, he's telling us the story, but Phyllis Dietrichson always remains in the shadows. I think that's what really helps this because by the time you realize, wow, she's really going in on trying to screw everybody over. And that story from Lola about knowing that she killed her mother and all that, it just creates an entirely different level of intensity through the movie.
Yeah. And I think it only works because as they're starting to plot the murder in the first place, she seems so timid. And so, yeah, she's committed to the plan, but she still seems very fearful of getting caught. We're fearful of it backfiring. Whereas as we get through, we just kind of start realizing how strong of a character she is, how easily she manipulates her husband into the car so that he can go on this train so that they can murder him and then happen to have this exact clause in the life or the accident insurance so that they can get the double indemnity clause. It's such a brilliant way of writing a femme fatale because it plays on our instinct to want to trust the character, which is exactly what Neff is feeling.
Yeah. Yeah, he wants to believe that she's got his best intentions in mind, just like he has her best intentions in mind. But you always know in a film noir that things are never going to work out as planned between all of these main characters, but they do, like you said, they do a really good job of taking their time with these characters and building up Phyllis Dietrichson to be what she is. They don't just immediately say, you know, she killed she was a nurse who killed whoever. They hint at it, but they don't say it right off. And I think that is what kind of, I'm trying to think of the word, but you know, those decisions, the slow burn on a lot of these characters, it helps. And what we really end up seeing is Walter Neff's not in love with Phyllis Dietrichson. He's just lonely as hell and just looking for a way to spice up his life. Because we see that when he's with Lola, he really cares about Lola. And that starts to actually take over as the love story, which is where the jealousy of Phyllis comes in, because she doesn't like that. But that starts to take over, and that's not something that you're expecting at the beginning, but I don't think he's expecting it. And Billy Wilder does such a good job of getting in the head of Walter Neff to not let us feel like, you know, oh, we already know where this is going to go. No, you feel like you're in love with this femme fatale, this really attractive woman within the house who, you know, is on your level in terms of the way they talk, the whole speed limit dialogue and everything. Like, I love all that. It's so good. But in reality, he's just lonely as all hell and looking for a way to make things a little bit more interesting.
Which is the most interesting thing about Neff's character, because he's such a, like I said, we've said it already. He's this anti-hero. He's this person doing bad things. We know they're bad, yet we still kind of root for him. And I think a lot of that comes down to, like, there's this human element to Neff's character where, and I think it comes to him describing exactly, you know, who hasn't thought about this, you know? Mm-hmm. I know the insurance inside and out. Like, I can deal with it. We can do this. Why wouldn't you just, you know, all the notches on the roulette table. Why wouldn't you just fix the house sometime? Mm-hmm. And you're like, okay, I get where you're going. But then because we have those scenes with Lola where we do kind of see him just be like this compassionate human being, it really helps humanize him despite how despicable his actions are.
Yeah. Well, because it's you have hope now that your character, that your protagonist, even if he's an anti-hero, is going to find the light, is going to ultimately just go away. This movie to me is one of the great ending lines of all time. It never gets the credit for it. Never. You know, that always goes to Frankly, My Dear, I Don't Give a Damn, or Louie, I Feel Like This Is the Beginning of a Great Friendship. And all the, you know, we talked about The Silence of the Lambs a couple weeks ago. I'm Having an Old Friend for Dinner. Like, there's so many great ones, but this one never gets it. But it's because it really takes on more meaning when you watch the movie. But when he says, you know, it was too close, it was right across the desk, and Edward G. Robinson says, closer than that, and he just goes, I love you too. It's brilliant, because that's what we're rooting for the entire movie. You're rooting for these two guys who like each other and respect each other so much. How Edward G. Robinson will go to bat for Walter Neff and say, hey, it's not him. I don't think so. Like, I've reviewed him. We've tailed him. It's not him, because that's how careful this guy's been. And this guy has been that careful because he knows how good at his job Keys can be. You're rooting for them to get for them to find a way to mesh. And at the end, when he's like, you're not even going to make it to the elevator, and he just lets him walk out. At least it's almost like he's giving him that chance. Hey, if you could make it, go ahead. But I know you're not going to make it. And I didn't want this to happen at all. That ending line just kills me every single time. I love it. I just the writing in this, Sunset Boulevard is normally praised as the best writing of Billy Wilder's career. I really think this is it. And I love Sunset Boulevard, as I've shown with where I have that in my list here. But I really think that this is the best writing of his career. But it doesn't help when you're one of the greatest writers in the history of film, because then you also have, you know, Some Like It Hot and Witness for the Prosecution and all that stuff that people are just like, all right, man, like, share the wealth a little bit. But this is, to me, just the best he's ever done.
Yeah. I mean, watching Double Indemnity this week has just solidified for me that Billy Wilder is just easily one of the greatest directors and writers we've ever seen.
Ever.
Yeah.
Ever.
And it's not even a question. Like, he's easy at top five. Mm-hmm. And, like, you can make arguments for other people, but to me, he's just so pivotal to what film has become, and just doesn't miss when he makes a film.
He doesn't. He really doesn't. And his whole thing was grab him by the throat and never let go. He does it in every movie. This movie starts off with the car and he's going into the office, bleeding, trying to light the cigarette. You're like, all right, what is going on? Tell me, talk. Come on, talk. Yeah. And then he starts talking. And he was so influential in every genre too. That's the most impressive thing. He did comedies. He did film noirs. He did everything you could ask him to do with the exception of war. And he nailed it every single time. He just nailed it. And I think that that is so, it's so, I don't want to say sad, but that's the only word that can come to mind. It's kind of sad that, you know, when people talk about who are the greatest of all time, they'll always go to like Scorsese and Tarantino and stuff like that, because those are the movies that were coming out in the 90s and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Wilder was so ahead of his time. His influence is seen on all of them, like on everybody. And you can't really say that about writers and directors from this time period a lot of the time, because a lot of them were just crammed into that studio system and they made a couple good ones here and there. I mean, Houston obviously made a lot of great ones. Capra made a lot of great ones. But again, Capra, he had his own distinct tone, but he was a product of the system.
Yep.
But Billy Wilder managed to be something else there. And I think that when you look back at like the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, Hitchcock always comes up, but Billy Wilder needs to come up a lot more, because he was just groundbreaking across the board. And, you know, when you can sit down and say, okay, what are your top like 10 movies for a director? And you are going down and you're like, well, Ace in the Hole, Some Like It Hot, Double Indemnity, Sunset Boulevard, Witness for the Prosecution. And I've only named five, and I could just keep going and going and going. The Fortune Cookie ends up winning, what's his name, an Oscar for supporting roles. Like, he was just Sabrina, which was remade into that terrible Harrison Ford movie, was great. Stalag 17. He made so many. And there you go. That's the war movie. I forgot he actually did have a war. Sorry. Yeah, I didn't even say The Apartment. Thank you. But Stalag 17 is a war movie. So he did make a war movie. Like, he literally did everything you could ask for. And, you know, he doesn't, you know, Hitchcock, Kubrick, those guys get mentioned. But Billy Wilder just needs to be talked about more as being
absolutely
as defining as he was.
Yeah, because he didn't miss. And that's the big, that's one of the greatest accomplishments anyone creating art could ever have.
I would say probably him and Kubrick are the two. I mean, Kubrick in his, you know, first or second movies, but neither one of them missed. And even if you didn't like one of their movies, it's normally a personal taste, not because the movie itself actually isn't very good. That's the difference.
Exactly.
All right, well, that's Double Indemnity. Love it. If you haven't seen it, you got to see it. I don't know how you haven't seen it. It's so good. Go check that one out. And check out everything by Billy Wilder, because it really is just unbelievable. Although it's funny, I figured out this week I own 13 Billy Wilder movies and I don't own Double Indemnity. And that's my favorite one. So I own 13 Billy Wilder movies, but I don't own my favorite of Billy Wilder's movies. Oh. Fun how that works. All right, John, what was the best thing you watched this week?
Well, with Oscar nominations yesterday, I started watching all these Best Picture nominations. So the best thing I watched this week was Belfast, which of course we're going to dive into later on a Patreon, but no, I really enjoyed it. I've always been a Kenneth Branagh fan. I quite enjoy like his Shakespearean approach to a lot of works, and this is a great movie. It really impressed me.
Yeah, I got to check that one out. I have seen 4 of the 10. So I got to check out Belfast, Drive My Car, Don't Look Up, Coda, Nightmare Alley, and King Richard. And so Belfast is, I'm actually going to go see it on Friday night because it's playing in theaters around here now. So I'm going to go check it out. They brought it back. But keeping in line with that, I finally sat down and watched The Power of the Dog. And that movie is awesome. I don't care what anybody says. I know that. So this movie hasn't been that divisive. But it is one of those movies like that audiences haven't necessarily connected as much. And I was talking to a friend about it. And I think a lot of this just comes down to the fact that like it's on Netflix. So it's very easy to see. It's got Benedict Cumberbatch, who's incredibly popular because of the Marvel universe. And now it gets nominated for all these awards. So more people are going to watch this movie than you would think. And it's a lot of people who this is not a genre for them. Like a lot of time, they would never watch this movie if it wasn't on Netflix. If this was out in the theater, they would have never sought it out. And so like, you know, it's IMDb score. I was just looking at it and I accidentally stumbled across it. It was like a 6.9. And I was like, holy shit, that's like as low as Shakespeare in Love. Like, that's crazy. And then I'm looking over at Letterboxd and it has like a 3.8, I believe. But I went into this and I was like, I don't really know what to expect. It's a Western, whatever. Man, I cannot get the scene the first time Cody Smith McPhee and Benedict Cumberbatch talk to each other out of my mind. And it's disturbing me and it's making me depressed and it's making me sad. And when he says it's actually to protect the drips, and then Benedict Cumberbatch screams, "Oh, did you hear that, boys? It's to protect the drips." And he mocks him with the lisp. It is so devastating. And like that has just resonated so much with me, and I can't wait to talk about this movie. I'm so happy Jesse Plemons got a nomination too, because he is so underrated, and in this movie it is such an understated performance. But I can't wait to talk about this movie when we do our deep dive. It is just, it was, I literally, with 20 minutes left in the movie, I'm like, damn, she lost me. Nope, she went too far, whatever. And then in the last 5 minutes, I was like, oh, that's where she wanted me the whole time. That she just, that's where she wanted me. It's just, it is so brilliant. And just the talent of the craft of Jane Campion in this movie. Yeah, it's just top notch. I mean, the way she's able to pull the wool over your eyes, for lack of a better term, is just brilliant.
Yeah, this is actually playing locally here next week, and I think I'm going to make a trip down to the theater to go see it again.
Yeah, because you've seen it already.
I watched it on Netflix, but this feels like a movie that you should go see in theaters.
I agree. That was so good. I was so into it the whole time. I didn't think I was going to be. I was so into it. And now I'll throw this out there. If you haven't seen The Piano, go watch The Piano, because it's freaking awesome. The Piano's great. If you haven't seen that, go check it out, because that's Jane Campion's, maybe her best. Power of the Dog's up there, but it's a great movie. So definitely check it out. But anyway. All right, John, let's talk about James Bond. The second time we're talking about James Bond on this podcast, even though I love talking about No Time to Die for the brief moments, I did say that it was the best movie I saw in a week. You Only Live Twice. You were very vocal about how you think this is the best James Bond. I have it as my number 10.
So
why you got it?
Okay. So I do want to reiterate, Goldfinger is the best James Bond movie from like a technical standpoint, in my opinion. But You Only Live Twice is by far my favorite James Bond movie because of these tropes that it brings in. It's such a weird movie in like the Sean Connery era, because it does kind of go a lot further on the like the goofier spy side, and it's a lot more similar to the Roger Moore era than it is to the rest of the Connery era James Bond films. Mm-hmm. But it has the script by Roald Dahl, beloved children's author Roald Dahl, and it's a bit absurd, but it's just absurd enough that it really keeps you engaged the entire time.
Well, it's just having fun. And I think that's where some of these Bond movies kind of lose it. Like we talked about Skyfall, which I think I might have Skyfall just above this one. I got to pull up my list so I don't say things I'll later regret. But I have Skyfall literally one spot above this. But Skyfall's just not that much fun. This one is fun. And while I prefer Skyfall to this one, it's barely preferred to this one. Like The Spy Who Loved Me is having fun, and that's why it's my favorite one. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they try to take themselves too seriously. Sometimes they get too goofy, like in the Pierce Brosnan second half. But I think that like this movie is really nailing what James Bond is supposed to become. From Russia with Love is one of the darker Bonds. And I really like that one. And that's, you know, up there on my list. I have that as my second favorite and all that. No Time to Die, I have as my third favorite. And that's a very dark Bond. But this one it's balancing that we want to take it seriously and we want to create a good story and we want you to know like what's going on and kind of ground it somewhat in reality. But also here's a toy helicopter and here's like, I don't know, like the one-liners in this are very, very good. And the fact that he dies at the beginning in air quotes, like there's just a lot of entertainment going on, and there, you know, the whole willing suspension of disbelief. This movie knows that you're going to willingly suspend your disbelief, so do it. Go do it.
Yeah,
and it makes it very enjoyable.
Yeah, and it establishes it right away, and I think that's what's so important with this, because sometimes in the Bond films, it takes us a while to figure out like what the plot is and where it's going with everything. But our opening scene in this is there's this space mission, and then all of a sudden, another spaceship swallows a spaceship.
Yep.
It's absolutely absurd. It's ridiculous. But it's just like, okay, that's interesting. And then you see the tensions between the Americans and the Soviets. And you're like, okay, I can piece together exactly where this plot's going from this small interaction here.
Yep.
And then you get our man's on it.
Yep.
And then we go to James Bond. And then James Bond dies.
Yeah.
And it's such a great way of opening a James Bond movie, because you're like, okay, there's no way James Bond can die. This is a James Bond movie. But you're still like, oh, maybe he did just die. Maybe something else is happening here. It's cleverly written in a way to engage you right away. And then when it takes you to this very different setting than we've had in other Bond movies, where we don't really have... We have this backdrop of the Cold War, but it's not as prominent because we're in Japan this time.
Mm-hmm.
It's different than James Bond movies, and just sets up what everyone thinks James Bond is in the future.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, like, with the whole dying part, like, you know that it can't be James Bond dying, but it's something that we hadn't seen yet. And what is this the sixth one or the fifth one? How many in a row?
The fifth one.
This is the fifth one. So we're five.
Thunderball, yeah.
Yeah, we're five movies in, and we haven't seen anything really bad happen to James Bond in any of these first five movies. You know, he'll get into the, oh, how's he ever going to get out of this? And then he does. But this is just a totally unique opening. It's totally different from any of the other movies. And it creates a pretty interesting tension going into the opening credit sequence, because you're like, okay, well, how is he going to get out of this one? You know, he's going to get out of it, but how is he possibly going to get out of this one? And I love the whole, like, they dump him off the boat and he's got the snorkel mask on and all that. Like, I love all that stuff, but even though it's a very short time, I love the tension it creates and how it also, though, very much influences the story. Why they wanted to make sure that he died, why they needed him to die, and so that they could move forward with what their plans were as the Russians and the US are going at it. And I always love that these movies are from the UK perspective, because it gets into when you live in America, you watch so many American focused movies, that to see it from the UK perspective while America's a bystander does actually, like, create a different dynamic than what I'm used to. And I like that. I think that makes it a lot more fun, because then also, what is it, 10 years later, we see Bond and the Russian working together in The Spy Who Loved Me. So, like, it's creating a different dynamic than what the other movies were doing at the beginning. And it's letting you know that, okay, this isn't just a spy movie. This is also very much set in, like, kind of a real setting. There are these tensions that are starting to happen here. And now, how is James Bond going to influence the outcome of the world with this?
Yeah, and it's also really clever that they don't reveal that it's Spectre until the end of the film.
Or until we brilliantly played by Donald Pleasance, too, by the way.
Donald Pleasance is the best Blofeld. There's no question about it.
Yeah.
And he's absolutely phenomenal in this film. But not revealing that Spectre's in the people pulling the strings with this does make you think along the lines of, like, the Americans and the Russians, where it's like, okay, but which country's actually doing this? Who's trying to incite this conflict? And especially when you don't realize, or especially when you finally get to the point where it's Blofeld's doing this for money. Mm-hmm. It's just like, there's monetary values to be gained in Russia and the States just blowing each other up.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And this movie goes there, but then it's, you know, James Bond will save the day because that's what he does. I also think, though, it's fun. I think that this movie has one of the most, even though it's between the Russians and the US, the fact that it's very much set in Japan and it has the volcano lair.
Yeah.
That's one of the best James Bond lairs there ever is. That's such a fun lair. I like that it uses its setting with, like, the ninja training and all of that. Like, I like that it goes to these, even if it's so dated now, 50, almost 55 years later, even if that part feels very dated, I like that they were utilizing that and that they were doing something with that, because we had seen in the other James Bonds, like the Caribbean or whatever. And it was like, and now the Caribbean sidekick dies or, like, whatever.
Yeah.
This is a different setting with a very fun lair that is a little bit more dramatic. I love all the ninjas coming in and that huge fight that's happening where everybody's just killing everybody. It's so over the top. But it makes for a damn fun movie. And that's really all you can ask for when it comes to a James Bond.
Yeah, it also gives us the best line in any James Bond movie. Do you have any commandos? No, I have better. I have ninjas.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. I love that. I love it. It's great. It's great.
Yeah, and I mean, like, we can't not acknowledge the troublesome aspects of this. Obviously, whoever thought putting Sean Connery in Yellowface to make him Japanese... Well, that was just poorly thought out.
especially poorly thought out, doesn't look Japanese at all.
Doesn't look Japanese at all. He very much looks like a Scottish man.
But I will say, if you're going to put somebody in yellow face or whatever in a movie, at least this one was doing so with purpose. It wasn't just like, yes. Oh, like it was, hey, we need you to go undercover. Now, does he look Japanese at all? No, not even remotely. But there was a purpose.
There was. And I really like the implications this movie has for the rest of the James Bond franchise. And it's not too, maybe I'm looking too deep into You Only Live Twice, but in the scene where Aki dies, with James right beside her and everything, and he kind of just like shrugs it off right away. It's so important that that happens the film before.
Yeah.
Honor, Majesty, Secret Service. Like, it's just such a huge character moment that you don't realize if you're only watching You Only Live Twice, as, you know, a lot of people do just watch Bond movies like one at a time because they do have that ability. But when you watch You Only Live Twice, and you see his kind of like nonchalant response to this woman dying that he's, you know, intimate with. And then you get Tracy dying at the end of the next movie. And you see like that actually has long-term repercussions for the entire franchise. It's so fascinating to see that this character death was there and just subtly put in place.
Yeah. Yeah. And obviously Bond, like with the Bond women and stuff like that, he kind of just flips through them. But I do like that does become more important even in the later Bonds, the Daniel Craig Bonds with the whole Eva Green thing. Those decisions, like the fact that like when Bond does let somebody in and then they die, all of a sudden it's a lot more devastating because we see how little he cares in so many other instances. So yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think that really works in this movie. And I loved when I hadn't seen all the Bonds. I'd seen most of them. And I sat down and I watched them all in order. Mm-hmm. And it really does help to watch them. And even though you don't need to, it's not like the Lord of the Rings where you're going to be like, oh, I just watched Return of the King and I have no idea what's going on. You're going to know what's going on, but it does help to watch these movies in order. It does make quite a difference.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I did as well when I finally got around to watching them all in order for the first time. But what it also showed me is You Only Live Twice has some of the best set design in the entire franchise.
Mm-hmm.
Like there are some other films have some like pretty prolific setting or sets in them. When you look at like GoldenEye, it has like the dam and the satellite and the statue cemetery and everything. But You Only Live Twice just has like a lot of sparsity in some of its settings. And I really enjoy that and how they really went out of their way to make this James Bond movie feel different than the four that preceded it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And I think that was a welcome thing. I'm looking, Lewis Gilbert did direct this one and The Spy Who Loved Me. And then he also directed The Seeming Pile of Shit that it was Moonraker. But he directed all three of those movies. And this was the first one he directed. And I almost wonder if like that was a purposeful decision. I'm not really familiar with the rest of his movies, but you know, maybe that's why they wanted to go with somebody who was a little bit more unknown, who was kind of just out there, who could take it in a different direction than what we were seeing in the earlier Bonds. That, you know, Dr. No, for all it's worth, is a pretty serious movie. From Russia with Love is a pretty serious movie. Goldfinger starting to have a little bit more fun, but it's a pretty serious movie. Thunderball is all over the place, but this one feels like it found that balance. That Thunderball tried to go a little too fun. This one found that balance in between. And I think that's why they obviously bring Lewis Gilbert back later in the franchise when the franchise was really struggling to make good movies. And they have him do The Spy Who Loved Me. And it's by far the best Roger Moore.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And this movie has other things going for it as well. Because, I mean, the title song is a top five James Bond song.
Yeah, I have to think about the other one.
Performed by Nancy Sinatra. It's so elegant as it comes in. And despite the fact that Blofeld does eventually say You Only Live Twice and like name drops the movie at one point, it feels so suitable. And whenever I think of Bond title themes, this is the one that always gets stuck in my head. Like, I will admit that like Goldfinger and Diamonds Are Forever are better James Bond themes, but You Only Live Twice is the one that like I'll just throw on at some point to just to listen to.
See, that's always the nobody does it better. That's always that's the only Bond I can ever think of at any time, anywhere, any place. That's the definitive James Bond. To me, that's like the definitive James Bond one. Obviously, Diamonds Are Forever is the more popular, but Nobody Does It Better is the one that just will not leave my brain ever. So, yeah, but Nancy Sinatra does a very nice job. Those intros and the title sequences, it's funny how much that caught on, because that could have easily been something that they would have abandoned at any point during the franchise. And now it's like what people are sometimes more excited to sit down and actually watch when these movies start going. Who's going to have the title song?
That's why it made it so awkward that they chose the wrong title song for Spectre. But that's neither here nor there.
Who sang the Spectre one?
Sam Smith sang the one that they used in the film. Mm-hmm. But Radiohead also wrote one for it, which is a way better song.
I haven't heard that. I don't even remember the Sam Smith one. So that tells you pretty much everything you need to know about how I feel about that.
But I really like that, because in the Bond movies preceding this, we saw like the Russian intelligence. We've seen Felix Leiter, and so we know the American intelligence. I really like the fact that because we're in Japan, we get the Japanese intelligence aspect of it as well. And what James Bond movies are really doing at this point is creating this network of intelligence agencies who cooperate with each other quite frequently, but no country really kind of acknowledges that it's cooperating with them.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and I think that's probably what's really happening in a lot of these instances, is you're having a lot of countries working together without acknowledging publicly that they're working together. And this movie does do a good job of doing that. And I think that speaks though to this franchise as a whole. It could have gotten so lazy, and there's points where it does get lazy, but it's trying to bring, at least in the Sean Connery ones, it's trying to bring something unique and different a lot of the time with, like, you know, you forget, he's in on His Majesty's Secret Service, but there's so many other areas of this when he works with the CIA or whoever else he's working with. And I think the Japanese intelligence, it adds to it, and then it also helps with the betrayals that go on, as everybody's got their people who aren't straight and narrow, like, that's it, they're just gonna do their own thing. And we see that in this movie, and it works. I mean, I love how they just kill the one girl in this movie. It's just like, yep, she's dead now, that's it. She was bad. She was not good, so she's dead.
Because you're referring to number 11, right?
Yeah, whatever her, I can't even think of what her name is.
12? It's one of the two. But we also get that iconic piranha pit at that point too, right? Yeah. Like, this is, like I was saying, this is kind of this quintessential, like, spy theme that we get from this film, where this is what's parodied further on. When you look at something like the Austin Powers series, if you rewatch the Austin Powers trilogy at this point, you will see how many of those films are making direct references to You Only Live Twice over the rest of the entire franchise.
Yep, absolutely. No, this is the franchise that it, this is the movie that it's looking at. I also think, like, the naked, when we were talking about Double Indemnity, I didn't talk about this, but the Naked Gun is very much pulling from Double Indemnity with the girl with the leg and stuff. So it's funny, like, though, to see these movies that 1967, 1944, and how they still have such an impact, whether it be on James Bond movies or on other franchises or on spoofs of these movies that are coming out 50, 60 years later, these are the ones that they're pulling from. And the other movies didn't have as much to take from. This also had the lineup in Japan, men always come first and women come second. And Austin Powers has the beautiful lineup, or sometimes not at all. And that's, like, it is a direct play on those words. And, you know, Mike Myers, it just shows his brilliance with what he was doing with the James Bond movies. But this is the one that he's pulling from the most. Even with the tram car, this has the tram car. And then that's where he gets stuck and he's trying to back his way out. Like, this was the one. And you would think, oh, he would go from Dr. No or Goldfinger or something like that. This is the movie.
And I think a lot of it just comes to the fact that this is fun. It's like we keep saying with this one, this is a fun James Bond movie. Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, Goldfinger, like I said, Goldfinger is technically better than this film. It has a more solid plot. It doesn't have as many plot points as this one does. It doesn't have as many ridiculous moments as, knocking on top of a volcanic lake and it, it's a door. But it doesn't quite have that fun element of that. It doesn't have the fact that, like, we get a training montage. We get a training montage in this James Bond movie that concludes with, this isn't one of our men. What's he doing here?
Yeah. I know. Like, they wouldn't notice.
Yeah. It's so great. And even the scene where James is going and doing... One of the great parts about this movie is we get to see James doing actual espionage.
Mm-hmm.
Where he's doing, like, business espionage to try to get an idea of why this, where this liquid oxygen is coming in from, so that they can try and figure out where this coastline is and where the villain's operating out of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And espionage, you forget, like, sometimes that, like, that is what this genre is supposed to be. Some of the time you sometimes forget that, like, that when the books were written, that was the intention, is that they were espionage spy thrillers. Like, that's what it was. And sometimes these movies do get away from it, but yeah, this one takes its time with a lot of the elements of Bond that the lesser ones don't really do well. You know, I think obviously, like, when I have this at number 10, I think I have three of the Daniel Craig ones ahead of it. That might just be because they're newer. And so I have four of the Daniel Craig ones ahead of it now, because I have Spectre, Skyfall, Casino Royale, and No Time to Die. That might just be that I connect with these more because they're coming out during my era. But You Only Live Twice is still one of the ones that latches on, that I hold on to. And I think it's my third highest rated out of the Connery Bonds, behind Goldfinger and From Russia with Love. This is the third highest one that I have, which I think is where a lot of people would probably put it. I don't think that
I agree.
Many would put it at number one like you do in terms of their favorite. But I think that almost everybody would put it ahead of Diamonds Are Forever, Dr. No, and Thunderball. I think that's a very common take when it comes to this movie.
Yeah, and why this movie so... I've talked about it before with James Bond. James Bond is kind of like this connection that I have with my father and, like, he had with his father. And You Only Live Twice is the perfect way, the perfect type of movie that you can share with a young child to kind of get them engaged in this franchise, where it's goofy enough that you're not sitting there completely bored out of their minds the entire time. And then it lets them appreciate the rest of the franchise so much more.
Yep. And I think, yeah, like, this isn't one that the parents are going to sit there and go, oh my God, I can't believe they're making me watch Moonraker again.
Yeah.
But it's still going to be one that if you're doing something else, you can pop in halfway through and be like, ah, I love this one. And then, you know, do whatever else you have to do. As opposed to, like, Goldfinger, you got to watch that whole thing. You got to sit down, you got to watch all of Goldfinger from beginning to end. This is one where it does have that kind of, like, you can pick it up at any point and just, sometimes that's the beauty of James Bond, though, is that feeling of, there's, like, that hominess that comes with it of, I'm just going to throw on a James Bond movie and that's going to be my night. And, you know, if I do something else, I could do something else. I'd prefer to sit there and watch the entire movie, but, you know, it does give you that feeling that, I don't know, you just can.
Yeah, exactly. It's what makes the James Bond franchise so endearing to so many people.
Yeah. And I will say that this one, like, even though it does have the politics of the UK and the US, I think it does a very good job of just, like, being like, yeah, but we're not a political movie. Like, we're literally just, we're a James Bond movie. Like, we're not trying to be something more than what we're trying to be. And some James Bonds toe that line a little bit, but this one is very much like, no, like, this is it. We're a James Bond movie. We keep our hands off. And, like, I do think, though, what the beauty of James Bond is that even when people, you know, just the people, I just say people, proverbial people, want to, you know, we should change this, it's outdated, whatever, they'll throw in their Judi Dench speech. But at the end of the day, James Bond is going to be James Bond. And that's the importance of James Bond, though, is that it is going to just be James Bond. That's what makes these movies fun. And that's what makes them so entertaining. And that's why people keep coming back to them year after year after year after year. And that's why we're all sitting here wondering, well, what could possibly be the next one, considering James Bond just exploded? So what are we doing next?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a franchise that will probably never die and will just continue living on in everyone's hearts.
Yeah, I agree, man. I agree. Well, I'm glad we got to watch that one, though. I'm glad that the ones we had. We only did Goldfinger and You Only Live Twice, right? Those are the only two we did. I'm not missing one.
That's correct.
Those are the two James Bonds that we had on this list. None of the James Bond movies made my top 100. So sucks, everyone. But yeah, there you go. Anyway. All right, John. That's it for these two movies. Next week, we are going to 1998. And we are doing American History X and Shakespeare in Love. And we're going to have a duel. John and I are going to have a duel. But that's right, folks. I'm talking about Shakespeare in Love, and I'm talking about it positively. So put on your tinfoil hats and tell me why I'm an idiot. But I can't wait for this one. I've been waiting for this one for a very long time. 48, American History X, Shakespeare in Love. Couldn't have worked out any better that it's two movies from the same year, too. And two movies that have very different followings based on, you know, one didn't get nominated for Best Picture and people adore it. One wins Best Picture and people absolutely despise it. Coming together to meet in the middle, where John and I are going to just have a good time talking about these two movies that are very, very different. But again, if you want to listen to us talk about the Oscar movies, become a $5 patron or higher. You would get all 10 episodes that we're going to do. We're actually going to record Licorice Pizza's episode right after this. So that'll be going up there either tomorrow or the next day, depending on how I feel about all of you. But so if you're interested, go ahead and listen to that. John and I will be doing one for each of the movies, even if it means I have to drive to, I don't know, Wyoming to watch Drive My Car. I have no idea how I'm going to find it, but I'm going to watch it at some point, and that's it. So thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next week with Shakespeare in Love and American History X.